So the surprising part relates to the fact that imagination is not simply one thing for Lewis, but that it can be embodied in many different ways.
This is All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty, your host and the creator of the show. My guest today is here for the first time, but the book we're discussing is one that I've actually chatted about previously. In 2015, several months before the release of The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis, I spoke with Dr. Jerry Root. This time I'm speaking with the other co-author. His name is Mark Neal. Welcome to All About Jack, Mark.
Glad to be here.
Well, now, Mark, even though Jerry already spoke with me about The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis prior to it coming out, let me have you first detail what the title actually means and then also provide an overview of the book.
Sure. The title refers to the way that Lewis approached the imagination with a nuanced understanding. In many of his works, he names a certain nuance of the imagination. For example, the absorbing imagination or the penetrating imagination. So the surprising part relates to the fact that imagination is not simply one thing for Lewis, but that it can be embodied in many different ways. In fact, Lewis identified more than 30 of these nuances. So why is this important? You've probably heard Jerry say it, but in the same way the Inuit peoples nuance their understanding of snow and ice. They're reputed to have 50 ways to describe snow. For example, there is a term for wet snow, snow that can be used to ice a sleigh's runners, or for the powdery snow that looks like salt. An understanding of sea ice is even richer, with 70 terms, including words that describe ice that lasts year after year, or ice where a layer of crystals forms as the sea begins to freeze, or ice that is filled with holes. In the same way, we can imagine that those living in desert areas might have a nuanced understanding of sand, or aviators or pilots. Those that fly might require different ways to describe air currents, or sailors require different ways to understand water currents and waves. So the book examines 12 different nuances of the imagination identified by Lewis and ties each of these nuances to one of his particular works across 7 of the genres in which he wrote. So it's an in-depth look at not only how Lewis used each of these nuances in his own work, but how we can begin to understand the imagination not simply as the land of make-believe, but as a source of truth about reality in the same way that reason is. And reason is typically where we live most of the time. It gives us our understanding of truth far more often than imagination. So this book helps to make the case for imagination as a viable way of understanding the world.
Well, now, Mark, how did you become involved in the book? And also tell us how you got into reading Lewis in general.
Sure. I've been friends with Jerry Root, who's the co-author of the book, for a number of years now. And I've been part of a group that meets pretty regularly at his house. We meet on Thursday nights. And we sit outside around a fire and we have great conversation. We do this all year long, even in the middle of winter when it's 10 below. There's a few hearty souls out there. And so on one of these nights outside around the fire, he asked me to write this book with him. And of course, you know, how could I refuse? And I had read Lewis off and on, you know, during my life and studied some of his works in college. But the 4 years that I wrote this book with Jerry was my first sort of intense foray into the world of Lewis studies. I had always sensed a fresh air blowing from Lewis. I think he provides different perspectives that resonate with me in a way that the works of many other authors don't. And so as I've been digging into Lewis's works, especially his literary critical works, I think I've developed a greater desire to know him better and continue reading and rereading not only Lewis's works, but the works he points us to. And as Jerry would say, Lewis opens more than wardrobe doors. And I think it's the embarkation of a journey that I'm really looking forward to.
Well, now let's go ahead and get into some elements more specific to the book. First, let me underscore the fact that the book is divided into two parts. Part one, Imagination and the Literature of the Mind. Part two, Imagination and the Literature of the Heart. Let me have you pick from the first part of the book to highlight some key points from one of the chapters to give more of a taste of what the book is like.
The satisfied imagination is one of the embodiments of the imagination that Lewis identified, and we examine that through his book Letters to Malcolm, chiefly on prayer. And so the satisfied imagination takes delight in the familiar, in the repetitive, in the mundane, in a way that brings our minds back to the eternal source of order and repetition. So its object is to re-enchant the familiar, enabling us to bring a new perspective to our everyday life. So the chapter takes a look, first of all, at the medieval cosmology in which Lewis really delighted as a way of visualizing some of the elements of the satisfied imagination and creating a framework on which to examine Letters to Malcolm. So it looks at the order and repetition of the universe and how the medieval scholastics delighted in that. I won't go into it here, but Lewis wrote a whole book on the medieval cosmology, and it's called The Discarded Image. And I would encourage everyone to read it. It's just a wonderful way to better understand not only Lewis, but much of his fiction. And you'll see elements of the medieval cosmology are apparent in just about all of his fiction. So a really important work. In Letters to Malcolm, we examine, among some other things, how prayer is a way for us to worship through our pleasures. If we see, for example, bird shadow flitting across a lawn or a full moon rising above the trees, we experience pleasure, and Lewis suggests that this pleasure can be a form of prayer or of worship. But it's a pleasure in the familiar. So we suggest that Letters to Malcolm outlines four obstacles to the satisfied imagination. The first is that we are asleep. We need to discover what it is that actually gives us pleasure to begin to recognize it. And these things come at us all day long. Lewis calls them shafts of the divine striking our sensibilities. The second is the need to wake up and stay awake. The third is the recognition that God is the supplier of both material reality as well as our own personal reality. And Lewis writes that we must learn to see each of these things as end products of divine activities. And in doing this, it will change how we view what to us is a very common world. The fourth is the act of remembering. Because if we don't have reminders, constant reminders, we will forget. It's why we have rituals like liturgy in the church. I think life lulls us to sleep, so we have to be told again and again. And we live in a world where the pace of life is incredibly fast, and we're just immersed in all these digital networks, and we sacrifice depth for breadth, all the time. And we have become a very shallow culture. So I think activating the satisfied imagination is an attempt to make, as the poet Robert Frost would say, a momentary stay against confusion. It's a way to slow down long enough to be able to recognize that we are asleep. And so to purposefully spend time unplugged. So only when we can experience silence and solitude and the space to think without interruption, I think then we can begin to understand how to use the satisfied imagination. And there's a great story that G.K. Chesterton tells in his book, Tremendous Trifles, that perfectly illustrates how the satisfied imagination works. And I'll tell it here. It's a short story, but it's a great one. So in the story, there's two boys, and they're playing in the front yard of their house. And it's a very small garden. It's got a little strip of gravel path, and there's a little patch of lawn, and there's a tiny little rock garden. And as they're playing there, along comes the milkman, and he's actually a fairy in disguise. So he grants each boy a wish. Well, Paul, who has always wanted to see the great wonders of the world, says, well, I want to be a giant because as a giant, I could easily do this. So he's made into a giant. And he strides off across the continent to see the Himalayas. And as he looks down upon them, they remind him of the rocks in the rock garden of his front yard. He wades across the ocean to see Niagara Falls. And as he looks down on it, it reminds him of the tap running in the bathroom. His brother Peter, on the other hand, chooses to be a pygmy, and at 2 inches tall, suddenly his world, the world he lives in, is transformed. The little patch of grass becomes an unimaginably big jungle, and the house becomes an impossibly big mountain. And G.K. Chesterton says that if we look fiercely enough at the facts actually before us, we can force them to turn into adventures. And that is The Satisfied Imagination in a nutshell.
Ah, excellent. Great story. Well, now, I'm sure you saw this one coming, as well as those listening here. How about from part two, which chapter would you like to spotlight to spark a potential reader into wanting to learn more?
The chapter, and I think it's probably one of my favorites that I wrote, is about what Lewis calls the absorbing imagination. And he looks at this embodiment or nuance through the lens of Lewis's poetry. Not many people read Lewis's poetry anymore. It's not been very well accepted by many Lewis scholars, but I think it deserves a closer look. I found it profoundly moving. So the absorbing imagination helps to establish commonality of definition between multiple viewpoints. Then it synthesizes those viewpoints to create a larger whole. So the idea is to keep us from becoming stuck in our own particularity, so that we might enrich our understanding and widen our imaginative grasp of a given thing. There's a great poem by the poet John Godfrey Saxe called The Six Blind Men and the Elephant. And in this poem, each of the blind men approaches the elephant, and one grabs hold of the tail, and he says, "An elephant is like a rope." One feels the side of the elephant, and he says, "No, an elephant is like a wall." Another grabs the leg and says, no, an elephant is like a tree trunk," and so on. And so each of those blind men had a particular experience of the elephant. But what they didn't do is allow for the other's perspectives to help them understand the elephant in a fuller way. And so that's what the absorbing imagination attempts to do, is to help us kind of combine multiple viewpoints to get a better understanding of a given thing. And Lewis himself did this in Prince Caspian by importing pagan myths into a Christian story and allowing the two to blend and create something new. For example, he uses Bacchus, the Roman god of wine, and also of ritual madness, and the Maenads, who were a sort of retinue for the god and were inspired by his madness into frenzied dancing. So the myth brings its own associations of history to bear on the story, enriching it and enabling us to see something in a new way. And Lewis speaks of the divided parts of his mind, the rift between reason and imagination. He writes about this in his poem called Reason. He says that nearly all that I loved, I believed to be imaginary. Nearly all that I believed to be real, I thought grim and meaningless. So Lewis wanted to know how he could make the what he called the dim regions of imagination ever report the same as intellectual sight. And he talks about this in his poem, Reason. This rift was ultimately healed for Lewis through the person of Christ. And we make the case in the book that the absorbing imagination was the vehicle for doing this. Lewis's first volume of poetry, Spirits in Bondage, is full of poems detailing this rift that I just described between his mind and imagination. And the anger that he felt at a god he didn't believe in. There's another volume of poetry simply titled Poems, and there's a definite change, and we see how Lewis is embracing the imagination as a source of truth and using it to blend traditions to create new meaning and help us experience and understand anew as well.
Now, let's take a broader approach to your book. If I'm not mistaken, there are 12 different imaginations that you do describe in addition to the appendix where others are detailed. But overall, how can we cultivate such a nuanced understanding of the imagination to help us live meaningful lives and expand our understanding of the world around us?
Well, first, I think we have to understand that the imagination functions as much more than simply what we'd call make-believe. I think just about everyone defines it in this sort of limited fashion and so believes it to be false. You know, when as a child we're told, "You just imagined it," that's not really an affirming thing. It's essentially the same as saying we're lying. So I think with Lewis, we need to perceive the imagination as a whole of nuanced parts. I think that's the first step. Then learning to trust that it can be a reliable source of truth about reality and over time, helping us to detach those negative connotations that we had of the imagination as a child. I think Lewis's own imaginative development was the result of extensive reading. So I think it's important that we do the same if we would develop our imaginations. Reading helps to stock the mind with images, and those images enable us to to be imaginative and help us in our imaginative endeavors. So at the end of Experiment in Criticism, Lewis writes that his own eyes are not enough for him, that he wished to see with other eyes. He even says that, "I regret that the brutes cannot write books. You know, very gladly would I see how reality comes charged to the eye of a bee or a mouse, or even how it is perceived through the olfactory senses of a dog." So Lewis is just desperate, almost in a sense, to have as many different understandings of reality as he can, because we, in a sense, we live in a prison of self, and we need those different perspectives.
Well, now, each chapter of your book underscores a specific book from Lewis to anchor a particular imagination, as you've noted. And among sharing the names of other works that also relate to them, you mention many essays from Lewis throughout the book. Now, from these shorter works, what top five would you say are ones that people shouldn't miss when they read Lewis directly?
And I don't know if these are the top five, but the five that I've got in mind, I think I found were pretty important and influential in the writing of the book. And there are three from the selection of essays called God and the Dock. The first is Myth Become Fact, the idea that we experience Christianity as a concrete reality when we taste it as myth. The second would be The Trouble with X, which is an essay that encourages us to deal with faults in ourselves rather than pointing them out in others. And then the third from God in the Dock would be this fantastic little essay called Meditation in a Tool Shed, which is important because it tells about two ways of seeing the world, looking either at or looking along. And Lewis describes the experience of standing in this dark tool shed. You know, the doors are closed. And as he's standing in the shed, he sees a beam of light come through the crack of the door. And he says, you know, while he was standing there, he could look at the beam and you know, everything around it was dark. But when he crouched down and put his eye along that beam, all of a sudden he could see the leaves moving in the wind outside of the shed. And in the distance, he could see the sun. So it's the difference between describing and experiencing. Fourth essay would be Imagination and Thought in the Middle Ages from the book Studies in Medieval and Renaissance Literature. It's a great intro to the medieval cosmology, which was a very important influence on Lewis and his writing. And then I think the fifth would be The Shoddy Lands from Of Other Worlds, which describes a sort of curious fictional incident that occurred when a friend visited Lewis in Oxford with his girlfriend. And Lewis was suddenly let into her mind to see the world as she saw it.
Continuing a theme of looking at Lewis' works directly, what would you say are your top two or three all-time favorite works from him, whether they be books or essays? And are there any more recently that you've especially enjoyed from his works?
Yeah, you know, I've been delving into Lewis's literary criticism because not many people read it, and I think it's some of his most important work. Many of the ideas that you see in his fiction were worked out in these books. So as I mentioned previously, The Discarded Image, I think, is foundational. The medieval worldview and the cosmology was so fascinating to Lewis, and we see elements of it, like I said, in so many of his books. I think I also mentioned that my imagination was captured by Lewis's poetry, particularly the volume simply called Poems, but also the pre-conversion volume entitled Spirits in Bondage. I also recently read Preface to Paradise Lost, which I then followed by reading the actual poem, Paradise Lost. And right now I'm working through Studies in Words, which is a fascinating yet extremely abstruse work by Lewis. Again, I think it's important that we read not only Lewis, but also the works that he points us to. So I guess I think that if we only read Lewis, we're just getting half the story. I believe that much of what he was as a person was the result of extensive reading and enjoyment of literature. So especially his literary critical works. And I think Lewis gives us new eyes to see the literature in a fresh way. In many cases, I think he helps us to see a particular work as the author meant it to be seen. So I would encourage people to read his literary critical works. They're not always easy, but he, again, as I've mentioned, he's developed so many of his ideas that you see in his fiction and his more popular apologetic works in those books.
Returning to your book directly here, While it's aimed at being an introductory for ecologists to use, why do you believe a more general reader would also enjoy this book?
Well, I think, you know, anyone with an interest in Lewis would enjoy the book. I think it's a great fit for anyone interested in Lewis's imaginative development and how that development impacted his own work. And I think it would also be attractive to anyone who simply wants to learn more about the imagination and its importance in our lives.
Now, during the process of writing this book, again, it's entitled The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis, what was the most surprising thing you learned and or experienced?
Yeah, this is a good question. You know, I'm learning how important it is to remember, to sort of incise the important things of life deeply on my mind, because I think as people, we are asleep, as I mentioned earlier. Occasionally, you know, the mist clears and we wake up a bit, but it's so easy to forget and fall away. So I think this is why we have holy days and places and liturgical traditions, things that will help fix our minds regularly on the transcendent in life. So I think having to interact with this sort of topic over the 4 years that it took to write the book helped to keep it sort of in the foreground of my attention and forced me to sort of wake up and see the world differently. The other takeaway is that I came to understand imagination differently. And as I mentioned, I think we've all grown up to see the imagination as sort of the land of make-believe, and to believe that it's essentially false. So I think I began to realize that the imagination is a source of truth about reality, just like reason. But it gives us a little bit of a different aspect than reason. And there are things that can be known with the imagination, but not with reason. And so I think that was an essential distinction for me. And Lewis gives us the language to help us make sense of this experience.
Very good words indeed to consider, and hopefully what you've been sharing here will help spark people the desire to want to get the book. But let's wrap up, Mark, by having you tell our listeners, well, first of all, where they can find you online, and then why they should consider, in summary, getting a copy of The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis.
Well, you can visit my website. It's markneal.org. That's markneal.org. Or you can connect with me on Twitter, and my Twitter handle is Mark E. Neal. So to answer your second part of your question, I think most people don't take the imagination very seriously. And like I said, they think it's make-believe, and they think make-believe isn't real. So the book really turns that assertion on its head. We believe the imagination is very real. And like I've mentioned a few times, provides us information about reality and truth that we can't get through the reason alone. It brings meaning and richness and texture to our lives. For those reasons, I think it's, you know, worth getting the book. And the book is about Lewis's understanding of the imagination, but it's also a lot more than that. I think it's a way to illuminate a path of exploration into the imagination that I would encourage all readers to take.
Excellent. I've enjoyed speaking with you, Mark, and I'll have a direct link in my show note to your website as well as Twitter, and then also to the previous interview I did with Jerry, as well as people can go online to their preferred place, but I'll have a direct link probably to Amazon to pick up the book, and then, of course, if they find it in the bookstores, we encourage people to get it however they can. Well, Mark, thanks for being with me here on All About Jack.
Thank you, William. I've had a great time.
Thanks goes also to you, the listener, for being interested in my interview with Mark Neal and the book he co-authored, The Surprising Imagination of C.S. Lewis. I'm William O'Flaherty, the producer of All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. As noted, you can visit my show notes for links that were mentioned today about Mark and his book. Those notes can be located either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.com. .podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the audio files are hosted, and it can be a little easier to find the shows there. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. The other location, essentialcslewis.com, provides links back to the podcast location, as well as a variety of other information, which includes articles related to Lewis about a daily fact quote and quiz question, and also a series exploring quotations attributed to Lewis that may or may not be by him. I hope you like today's show enough to want to share it with others. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. At the time this podcast is released, my most recently new shows included a repost of an essay chat that focused on just one of Lewis's shorter works, and then also a brand new interview, a book called 75 Masterpieces Every Christian Should Know. Additionally, if you follow this show either at the Podbean or iTunes location, you can see that I've been reposting older shows typically during the week between the official postings I do. If you don't know how to find the show on iTunes, then be sure to check the show notes for a direct link back to it. Again, those notes can be found either at EssentialCSLewis.com or AllAboutJack.podbean.com. This episode of All About Jack is sponsored by Shelley & Son Books. You can find Shelley & Son Books online at ShelleyAndSonBooks.com. They specialize in rare books by Lewis, Tolkien, and the Inklings, and others. You can order by their website, phone, or email. They accept a variety of payments, and you can browse and search their catalog online. Again, find them online at ShelleyAndSonBooks.com. Finally, don't forget my book, C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters, will be out before too long, or if you're listening to this after March 2016, then it's already available. Either way, you can learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. There you can get a free 20-page PDF sample of the book. Again, that's ScrewtapeCompanion.com.